shuts his eyes.
Welcome back to Nate Timsley of the Land. I want to introduce our phone number now. There was a caller that was about to get onto our show, and I'd like to encourage her to call back. We'd be glad to have her on the show. The phone number for the show is 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. So if you've got a question or a comment, call in and we'll get you on the air. One other preparation for winter that we should touch base a little bit about was the seasonal butchering. And this is really an important part of, I think, pretty much every rural family of the period. This was laying in the meat supply for the winter. I'm very thankful to say before our family quit butchering, I was part of a butchering operation and did every step of the process. I made up my mind and I saw that my dad was not able to do it anymore, that I would step in and do it one time because I wanted to be sure I knew how. And I'm sure glad I did that because the process of butchering usually took place this time of the year because you wanted the meat to be able to be kept in cold conditions so you didn't have any question about spoilage. And the carcass would hang in the shed overnight and cool down. And then the first thing my mother always did was for supper that first night, she would have my dad peel out a section of ribs. Now we go to restaurants and have a rack of ribs. Well, my mother was making ribs way back when I was a child, and she'd throw a rack of these ribs in the oven with salt and pepper. And while we were doing chores, those ribs would be roasting. And I don't know if folks realize this, but fresh pork has a different taste. There's a different flavor to fresh pork that comes right out of a carcass like that. It's kind of a more of a Swedish type taste to it. So if you haven't experienced that, you maybe don't know what I'm talking about, but I would encourage anybody to try and get access to really fresh pork. And the other thing, unique thing my mother did is that she would can pork. So she would take some of the, what we would regard as higher cuts, quality cuts, like something you'd maybe turn into a pork chop. And she would cut that into small squares and put it in a masonry jar, and it would be heated in a canner on the stove, and those cans of meat would go into the basement, and it was some of the most delicious food I ever ate, and it would come out for a meal, and it would go into a frying pan and be heated up. And these are all examples of a culture that now has disappeared, but this is how farms could be self-sufficient. We didn't have to go to the store every 2 days. We didn't have to have big freezers. We were able to survive on things that we had already produced on our farms. So do you want to say a little something about butchering, Jerry, and then we'll go on to another question?
Sure. What you described is pretty close to what we did on our farm. We always butchered a hog every fall. And one of the things my mother did with pork chops is she put them in a crock with lard surrounding them to preserve them, which is kind of an interesting idea when you think about it, because one of the processes in butchering a pig was to we called it rendering the lard. In other words, capturing the fat in such a way that we could use it another day. Something else that we did, in addition to what you had mentioned, and my mother canned pork as well, was we had the hams and the bacon smoked at a butcher shop in Wautoma. And I tell you, in a cold winter day, my mother would go down, these hams and bacon hung on hooks on the way down to the cellar alongside the wall. She would bring up a ham and slice off three or four or five big, thick slices and put them with some kind of a milk mixture on a cast iron skillet on the wood stove. I tell you, I can taste that right today. How wonderful that smoked ham in a milk mixture was. And the bacon, oh my gosh, to have thick slices of bacon, again, simmering in a cast iron frying pan with a mixture of the smell of bacon with just a hint of wood smoke. I can smell that today. It brings back so many memories. But we need to go on, Nate.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for all of those recollections. And there were no preservatives in any of this meat we've been talking about, of course.
Certainly weren't.
So as we've been talking about transitioning in the farm to winter, I want to raise a question now about we're at a kind of a crucial era in the state of Wisconsin's agricultural history in that we are looking at the transition of the style of agriculture that we have been practicing in recent years, which might be called industrial agriculture, to what is going to come next, the new future. And so I'd like to raise the question, what is the future of Wisconsin agriculture? Jerry, and would you comment on that?
Sure. I thought about this quite a bit. One of the things I suspect a historian should not do is to spend a lot of time thinking about what the future might look like. But I must confess, having been a farm boy and still running a farm, today I am concerned about what I'm seeing happening. And one of my concerns is that the idea of the farm neighborhood, with farmers every quarter mile or so all working together, that's disappeared, mostly. It's the mantra of bigger is better has engulfed agriculture, I think, in my biased judgment, in a negative way. Bigger, in my view, bigger is not always better. And as a result, we have emerging, as Nate correctly pointed out, what might be called, what is often called, industrial agriculture. When we think of agriculture as a factory, a farm as a factory, that's not, in my judgment, that's not the way to think about a farm. A farm is not a factory. And when you think factory, you think inputs and outputs. You think economics and profit. And you don't think about things like relationship to the land, or to think about the land as something that's a living creature itself. Land is simply another part of the economic picture in the minds of some folks, not all, to be sure. So we are at a point where agriculture has, in a sense, two or three different movements going on. There's this industrial side where 1,000 acres of corn year after year in the same property might be something that we, and I see that fairly often, or it might be a herd of cattle that never get to go outside, and it might number 4, 5, 6, 7, 8,000. Can you imagine? I can't. I know it exists. I've driven by some of these mega dairy farms. So there are problems with industrial agriculture, but there are also glimmers of hope. And I might back up and say that it's the responsibility of each of us, not just a few policymakers, not the industrial farmers, not the industrialists, not big business that's making all that has responsibility for making decisions. It's everybody's job, because farms mean food, and we all eat. And without our concern, everybody's concern, no matter where we live, no matter what we do, no matter what the level of our education, what our religion, our politics, we ought to accept the responsibility that the decisions made about agriculture are our decisions, are everybody's decision. And so what are some of the alternatives that are emerging? And some have been around for quite a while. Organic farming. That's been around for a while, and that seems to be has considerable growth. Wisconsin has the largest group of organic dairy farmers. I should say it differently. The Organic Valley, an organization here in Wisconsin, cooperative, has the largest number of participants in the country. So that's an example of an alternative. And there are several others. There's something called, and it sounds a little silly even to say it, sustainable agriculture. Uh-huh. What's that all about? Well, if you look at what we were doing in agriculture in the 1950s and 60s and go back to the 40s, that was sustainable agriculture. Animals and crops were together on the same farm. And now there are people talking about that as if it's a brand new thing. It's not a new thing. It's adapted in a new way. It deals with technology in a different way. But it's based on the idea that the land, we must pay attention to the land. And we must pay attention to the future, not just the next quarter, the next 6 months, not the profit at the end of the year. But what's this land going to look like 5 years from now, when our kids and grandkids are thinking about going into farming? So the sustainable agriculture movement is another. Then there are several others that we could talk about. Community-supported agriculture, where urban people sign up with nearby farmers for their vegetables that are delivered regularly. Small acreage farming, we're seeing an increasing number of people that are coming back to the land, leaving behind often a urban job and wanting to raise their kids in the country, wanting to get away from the hustle and bustle of the city. And that's kind of an interesting movement. And then I've mentioned one other. There's a movement called the grazers, a grazing movement. And the idea of that is that cattle, dairy cattle, in fact, hogs, chickens, the whole everything, all animals should have an opportunity to be out on the land, to be where the sun shines, to eat grasses and legumes and that sort of thing. So the grazing movement has a backing and has an encouragement. So all of that these are positive alternatives. But it seems to me that industrial agriculture, and maybe I'm out of step when I say this, I don't think it has a long-term future. I don't. So I'll leave that at the moment at that, Nate, and you may have another question, or somebody may call in with a question.
Yeah, well, that's you introduced a lot of ideas about where agriculture might be going in the future, and I think we all ought to be contemplating, and many of us who want to get engaged in planning and engaging for the future need to get into this and think about it and get involved. So we're going to take a break here again, and we'll be back shortly for questions or comments or more discussion. Be back in a few minutes.
Oh, are you helpless? Yes, that's what he'll say. But at least not hopeless.